Good morning. It's time to read the Mason City Globe Gazette for Friday, February 28th, 2020. I'm Diana Black, and my partner at the microphone for the next hour is Anna Marie Wilson. We're pleased to be with you. This broadcast is made possible through a partnership between the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. Here are today's headlines on the front page of the Globe Gazette. Mason City's historic Suzy Q Cafe is open once again. Kensett responds to audit report, and five North Iowa teams heading to state.
And Mason City's weather, the regional outlook, mostly sunny and cold today. Expect 6 to 10 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity of 75% and poor drying conditions. Mainly clear tonight. Average relative humidity 85%. Times of clouds and sun tomorrow. Expect 3 to 6 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity of 75% and poor drying conditions. So today, mostly sunny and cold. Wind northwest 7 to 14 miles per hour, and the high will be 25 and the low will be 13.
Mason City's historic Suzy Q Cafe is open once again. 73 years after first opening, almost 1 year since being sold by the previous owner, Troy Liebenhagen, and a little more than a month since it was mentioned in Mayor Bill Schickel's Decade of Doing speech, Mason City's historic downtown restaurant, the Suzy Q Cafe, is doing business again. According to manager Thamira Lytle, business has been steady since the 10-seat restaurant had a soft opening Tuesday for lunch. Near closing time of 3 p.m. on Wednesday, seating at the brand new counter was still at a premium. It's one of just several parts inside the Suzy Q that needed some TLC. Lytle previously said that she and head cook Stephanie Zick thought they'd be able to reopen not long after the place was sold, but that's not how it worked out at all. We discovered that the place was in pretty rough shape, clearly due to years of existing as a popular greasy spoon in downtown Mason City, she joked. Most of the restaurant's infrastructure needed to be updated, and although the changes to the Valentine Diner's interior are immediately noticeable, tweaks to the menu are a little more subtle. The pork tenderloin stayed put, but is now accompanied by a few more health-conscious items, salads and such, as well as some sweeter fare, milkshakes and malts. Dressings, like the ranch offering, are homemade and pack a robust dill flavor. It's a blend of old and new, familiar and fresh. Valentine Diners were the brainchild of Arthur Valentine of Wichita, Kansas, and became popular shortly after World War II. They were designed and sold as portable sandwich shops that could be loaded on the back of a flatbed truck and moved from one location to another. The diners are shaped in the form of a railroad car and have a counter and 10 stools. Since Mason City's opened in 1947, it's had multiple owners, including Renus Lytle, Marlon Butts, and Troy Liebenhagen. Liebenhagen purchased the business from Lewis Awe in 2007 and did a facade renovation in 2014. He finally sold the diner in March 2019 for about $70,000. In October 2019, the restaurant was named Iowa's Best Hole-in-the-Wall Cafe by MSN. In the article, writer Kirsten Hickman said, "It may look small, but this little cafe in Mason City, Iowa sure is mighty."
Kensett responds to audit report. On Wednesday, February 19th, State Auditor Rob Sands' office released five separate reports covering specific city, county, and commission activity across the state and outlining possible issues on these areas. One of those five focused on a one-year stretch of time from July 1st, 2018 to June 30th, 2019 in the North Iowa community of Kensett, and what it found were issues with the local government division of duties, as well as reports not being prepared and council minutes not being published. In total, the audit report had 22 findings with recommendations accompanying each one. Not requirements or mandates, but recommendations. The City of Kensett's Mayor, Corey Pulgi, and its City Clerk, Lori McNally, don't necessarily dispute the findings, but take issue with some of the recommendations and the idea that there are problems with the City's fiscal responsibility. Almost all of these issues were procedural and not financial, McNally reported. And repeatedly said, she added that even some of the issues that the audit report raised were actually addressed by the city, just not in the manner state officials preferred. For example, the report recommended that Kensett officials should reconcile bank and investment account balances with the general ledger on a monthly basis and resolve any discrepancies in a timely fashion. They were also reconciled. They were always reconciled. They just weren't on the day they wanted, McNally said. According to her, in the 28 years she's worked for the city, there's never been an auditing issue. The local government is small, with 4 part-time employees, but plagued with problems. And she went further to say that if anything she was doing was a part of the problem, she would take steps to rectify that almost immediately. If I wasn't loyal to my town, I wouldn't come back to my office, lock the door, and never come back, McNally said. Though Pulgi hasn't been involved with the local government as long as McNally, he also said that these aren't debilitating issues. Most of the stuff is easily corrected in the future. And some of that can be handled when the town has its council meeting in March. Even though there's no timeline to act on the state audit report, Pulgi and McNally mentioned they'll work to address what there are the most pressing issues. It'll be done as time permits. I'm a part-time city clerk, McNally said. What needs to be done will be done. Both McNally and Pulgi also took care to say that such a report isn't an indictment of their town. It's just a reflection of how small we are and we make do with what we have. McNally was even more succinct in her framing of the audit. It doesn't reflect on the city of Kensett. The state audit was part of a so-called periodic examination and is done as a way to provide oversight of Iowa cities.
5 North Iowa teams heading to state. Then there were 5. Wednesday night was very productive for 4 North Iowa girls basketball teams as they cinch spots at next week's 2020 Iowa Girls State Basketball Tournament in Des Moines. Those teams joined Clear Lake, which punched its ticket to the Class 3A state tournament with a 65-47 win over Okoboji in the Class 3A Region 2 on Saturday. In Class 1A, both Bishop Garrigan and St. Ansgar came out victorious. The Golden Bears cinched their spot with a 63-46 win over East Buchanan in the regional finals. For St. Ansgar, the 60-51 win over Central Elkader gave the Saints their first state tournament since 2001. The Class 2A Osage and West Hancock both secured their spots in Des Moines. After 3 state straight seasons of losing in the regional finals, the Green Devils finally pushed their way through thanks to a 67-60 win over Emmitsburg. West Hancock walloped Panorama 67-28 as the Eagles made another step in their attempt to avenge last season's loss in the state title. If you want to see your favorite teams live at Wells Fargo in Des Moines, here are the pairings. Number 5 seed St. Ansgar will play number 4 seed Montezuma on Wednesday, March 4th. Number 3 seed Bishop Garrigan will play number 6 seed Martinsdale St. Mary's on Wednesday, March 4th. Class 2A, number 4 seed Osage will play number 5 seed West Branch on Tuesday, March 3rd. Number 2 seed West Hancock will play number 7 seed Logan Magnolia on Wednesday, March 4th. And in Class 3A, number 2 seed Clear Lake will play number 7 seed Davenport Assumption at 8:30 p.m. on Monday, March 2nd.
Steckman seeks re-election to Iowa Senate. House Assistant Minority Leader Sharon Steckman announced Wednesday she will seek her 7th term in the Iowa House of Representatives. Steckman, Democrat from Mason City, represents District 53, which includes Mason City, Rockwell, and Central Cerro Gordo County. It's an honor representing North Iowa and serving the hardworking people of District 53, Steckman said. I am proud of my work in the legislature, but there is more to be done. We must prioritize education for all Iowans, from kindergarten through 12th and beyond, and invest in our classrooms to make Iowa schools number one again. She said she also wants to ensure Iowa is an attractive place to live by taking care of its natural resources, protecting and enhancing its waterways, and investing in conservation practices. In addition to serving in Democratic leadership in the Iowa House, Steckman serves on the Administration and Rules, Education, Environmental Protection, Natural Resources, and State Government Committees. In years past, she served as ranking member of the Education Committee. Steckman is a retired educator, taught in the Mason City School System District for 30 years before rerunning for the Iowa House. She and her husband, Alan, live in Mason City. They have 4 children and 8 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren. She is a member of Trinity Lutheran Church.
Versteg, low solvency ratio not a concern. At the February 17th Mason City School Boards of Education meeting, the district's solvency ratio came up, part of a routine presentation by Finance Director Sherry Yoder. The district's budget each January during the past 5 years showed a solvency ratio in the double digits, with a peak of 13.6% in FY18. January's solvency rate for fiscal year 2020 is less than half that amount at 5.9%. A school district solvency ratio is a point-in-time measurement of the percentage of revenue the district would have should its doors close on June 30th with all its bills paid. The State School Boards Association recommends a ratio of between 5% and 15%. Such a marked decrease would seem an indicator of financial difficulty, but it's not really the case, says Yoder Superintendent Dave Versteg and Iowa finance experts. How did we get here? According to Yoder and Versteg, there were 2 factors that impacted the solvency ratio. One was unavoidable. We're always operating a year behind, Yoder said, mostly because of the way state and federal funding mechanisms work. The district received funding from the state this year based on last year's numbers, except this year enrollment grew, forcing the district to find an additional $600,000 to serve them. The second factor is one that many districts in Iowa, as well as other states, deal with, funding for special education. This year, the district dealt with some unforeseen costs, mainly in staffing, Versteg said. The district's special education services operates at a $3.5 million deficit, and each year it goes to the state school budget review committee to ask for the authority to spend the maximum allowable to cover special ed. What does this mean? Although a recommended range of solvency ratios has typically been somewhere between 5 and 15%, the lower range considered good and the higher range considered excellent, school boards should consider local reasons and local levels based on acceptable levels of risk that could justify a deviation from the recommended range. That's according to the Iowa School Finance Information Service, a consulting service that helps districts navigate complex school funding issues. I've seen plenty of districts with negative solvency ratio that were healthy financially, Versteg said. That's borne out on the State Department of Education website, which doesn't mention low solvency ratio as an indicator that warrants its intervention. When a district exceeds its spending authority, however, that's another matter. What's spending authority? If you're still following along at this point, you get an A+ in school finance. A district spending authority is what Versted calls its credit card. It's how much the state allows the district to spend under the state law, and it's the number one indicator of a district's financial health. Mason City has a problem there, except that it's a better one than heading into the red. Right now, the percentage of unspent budget hovers around 20%, but it's climbing. There's such a thing as being too good a money manager. Once a year, the state allows the district to burn 20% of the previous year's unspent budget into cash. But if the percentage of unspent budget climbs above 20%, that potential indicator to the state, a district may be collecting too much revenue. So how does the solvency ratio get righted? The same way we balance a checkbook, make more or spend less. Versteg and Yoder are taking a wait-and-see approach since the solvency ratio is still within acceptable limits and February's financial snapshot already shows the ratio is climbing. And it appears the school board was comfortable as well. There's no comment on the ratio during the meeting.
Senators seeks new security scrutiny. For Republicans in state Senate voted Wednesday to require Iowa's receiving public assistance benefits to undergo eligibility reviews four times a year that they said were meant to weed out fraud and abuse. Senators voted 32-17 along party lines to approve Senate File 2272 and send it to the Iowa House for consideration. The proposal would enlist one or more private vendors to verify the eligibility of about 600,000 public assistance recipients for their income, assets, employment, residency, incarnations, status, lottery winnings, and other information, and report to the Iowa Department of Human Services every 3 months beginning in October 2021.
What to know about the coronavirus? CG Public Health is advising residents about what they can do to prepare for the potential spread of the novel coronavirus known as COVID-19. To date, no one in Iowa has tested positive for COVID-19. Since the start of this outbreak, Sarasota County Public Health has worked closely with the Iowa Department of Public Health to monitor potential cases of COVID-19. And Sarasota Public Health Director Brian Hamp, we have and will continue to meet with our local response partners like Sarasota County Emergency Management, Mason City Fire Department, and Mercy One North Iowa to be ready in case the virus does come to Iowa. A person can prevent the spread of all viruses, including the flu and the coronaviruses, by covering coughs and sneezes with a tissue or their upper arm elbow and clean their hand frequently with soap and water and stay home when feeling ill. The CDC is not recommending general face mask use. Residents should prepare for the potential of COVID-19 in the same way they prepare for severe weather or other events that could disrupt their normal routine. This includes making a plan and discussing it with your family. What would you do if you could not go to work or school because of illness? What if your daycare provider was ill? How would you get your medications or groceries if you were ill? There are all questions to consider. A list of what you can do to prepare is located on the Sarasota County Department of Public Health website. Symptoms of the COVID-19 in people who have been exposed can include fever, cough, and shortness of breath. The symptoms may appear in as few as 2 days or as long as 14 days after exposure. CG Public Health will be continuing to monitor and provide updates as the situation changes.
Nations seek virus containment. Saudis cut off holy sites. Officials retrace steps of California patient. Saudi Arabia cut travel to Islam's holiest sites. South Korea toughened penalties for those breaking quarantines. And airports across Latin America look for signs of sick passengers Thursday as a new virus troubled a mushrooming swath of the globe. With the illness pushing its way into the sixth continent and the number of sick and dead rising, the crisis gave way to political and diplomatic rules. Concern that bordering on panic in some quarters, and a sense that no part of the world was immune to the diseases, spread. As growing parts of Europe and the Middle East saw infections and a first case was found in South America, air routes were halted and border control toughened. Japanese Prime Minister called for schools across the country to close for weeks, a decision that impacted 12.8 million students. In South Korea, the hardest hit countryside outside of China, four Bushman markets known for colorful silks and array of other wares were shuttered while the country's military sent hundreds of its doctors and soldiers to aid in treatment and quarantines. The holy city of Mecca, which able-bodied Muslims are called to visit at least once in their lives, and the Prophet Muhammad's mosque in Medina were cut off to potentially millions of pilgrims, with Saudi Arabia making the extraordinary decision to stop the spread of the virus. Meanwhile, California and federal officials were in the midst of an intensive effort Thursday to retrace the movements of a Northern California woman, believed to be the first person in the United States to contact the highly contagious coronavirus with no known connection to travel abroad or other known causes. She stayed at the hospital for 3 days, but doctors did not test her for the virus because she did not meet the federal stating criteria. North Bay Healthcare Group President Amy Bearer said in a statement she was then transferred to a Sacramento hospital where she was later tested positive for the virus.
Why are Sirego cacti being removed for wall? In Arizona, cactus rustling, stealing, or killing the state's iconic saguaros is a felony. It's illegal to shoot or deface the iconic cactuses or to remove them from the parks where the slow-growing succulents can reach more than 60 feet and live up to 200 years. Violators are pursued by state agricultural police or cactus cops. That hasn't stopped federal contractors from plowing over saguaros to make room for President Donald Trump's border wall. At least a half a dozen saguaros were uprooted this month by crews cleaning a dirt road next to the new border fencing at Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, about 150 miles southwest of Tucson near the Lakeville border crossing. Remains of the saguaros, some of which stood taller than 30-foot wall, were dumped under some other debris near a hill that crews started blasting with explosives this month to build the wall. The company Southwest Valley Constructors has a $789 million contract from U.S. Customs and Border Protection to build 38 miles of border fence in the area. They have quite clearly tried to hide the body of this cactus, said Lake and Jordan, a former Oregon pipe contractor who is now a campaigner for the Tucson-based Center for Biological Diversity, which has sued to stop the wall. During a visit to the construction site last week, Jordal took photos and videos of what he called saguaro carcasses. He has posted footage online, spurring outrage. The cactuses are typically described in terms as the outspread branches are arms and bare spines, ribs, and the skeletons of saguaros that died evidently of natural causes. It's easy to see why Arizona's tribe believes saguaros have spirits. They really all do have their own personalities, Jordal said. Some of them have been here longer than the border itself. What right do we think we have to destroy something like that? The saguaro blossom is Arizona's state flower, and the saguaro has its own federal park in Tucson. Even on private land, you need a state permit to move them. On the Tohono O'odham Reservation, the largest within Arizona, saguaros are considered sacred. The tribal calendar organized around the harvest of their sweet red fruit. Nurseries charge $100 a foot for saguaros. Mature plants can go for thousands of dollars. Border Patrol officials say that contractors have destroyed only a few and only ones that were unhealthy and could not be salvaged. Some scientists disagree. pointing out that transplanting a large cactus is often tantamount to killing it. More than 90 of the cactuses in the border wall construction are near the Oregon pipe and have been carefully transplanted. As of this week, the agency and the National Park Service have moved 2,200 cacti from the area. Before wall construction began, the agencies collaborated on a vegetation and plant relocation plan to minimize impacts to the protected and sensitive plants. Matthew said workers had mapped cacti and other protected plants within the 60-foot federally owned border zone known as the Roosevelt Reservation, where the wall and an adjacent access road were being built. Workers were trying to preserve agave, octala, and various cactuses, including saguaro, fishhook, nightbloom, Senta barrel hedgehog, and park's namesake, Oregon pike. Less than 10% of the cactuses in the border wall construction zone at Oregon pike have been removed so far, he said, and healthy plants have been placed elsewhere. Jordan remains skeptical. Every time I visit, I see hundreds of butchered cacti. During a visit on February 18th, it was not clear which saguaros at Oregon's pipe had marked for destruction. In the path of the access road, widening two saguaros, each more than 30 foot tall with an arm, suggesting they were at least 95 years old. They showed no signs of decay. Nevertheless, the next day workers had widened the road, uprooted, chopped, and discarded the two saguaros underbrush. On Wednesday, the Border Patrol spokesman declined to comment. The cactuses could soon be threatened elsewhere. To the west, in the crews from Tempe, Arizona, could be seen skirting saguaros as they widened the main east-west dirt road, Devil's Highway. Fisher has a $268 million contract to build about 31 miles of border fence in that area. Road widening is scheduled to begin soon, including a relocation plan for saguaros and other cactuses. A licensed arborist will inspect the plant's health and likelihood of successful transplantation in the area, and then an environmental monitor will verify the number and location of plants to be moved by hand with a shovel and protected wrapping or a specially equipped cradle truck. There's not much that saguaro defenders can do to stop federal contractors from felling them. They're not endangered like other Arizona cactuses, and the Trump administration has waived environmental laws protecting even those species by the wall's path. Representative Paul Raro, an Arizona Democrat who represents the Oregon Pipe era, and Ned Norris Jr., chairman of the Tohono Old Men, which is about 35,000 members, of whom roughly half live in the reservation, visited the park together last month. They complained about the environmental damage border wall construction was causing and pleaded with the Border Patrol to stop and consult with local officials. Instead, in addition to destroying saguaros at Oregon Pipe, construction crews used explosives this month to blast a path for the wall through Monument Hill, a Native American burial ground. Saying the Border Patrol cares about the environment impacts of border wall construction is absurd to anyone who has seen the destruction at Oregon Pipe, said Guave, who led a hearing on Washington on Wednesday about the effects of the border wall construction on indigenous communities. Wave laws along the borderlands have facilitated this destruction at an alarming pace. If construction continues, the damage to the iconic saguaros of southern Arizona will be irreparable. Attempts to gloss over the needless destruction of saguaros is another reminder of the harm being caused by this ridiculous border wall, Norris said. All of this is being done as federal agents still have not held any meaningful conversations with the nation, which are mandated by federal law and executive order. Moving saguaros can be delicate business. Saguaros rely on carrot-shaped tap roots that run several feet deep and a complex network of shallow roots that can extend nearly 20 feet and are difficult to reestablish, especially if they're moved to a different type of soil, and may rot if untreated, according to Bill Peachy, a Tucson-based independent scientist who has researched and rescued the cactuses for years. Problems are not always immediately apparent. Just as saguaros grow slowly, it can take years for them to die.
Stock continues week-long skin. The Dow Jones Industrial Average sank nearly 1,200 points Thursday, deepening a week-long global market rout caused by worries that the coronavirus outbreak will wreak havoc on the global economy. Bond prices soared again as investors sought safe places to park money, sending the yield on the 10-year Treasury to another record low. More companies, including Microsoft, are warning their results will be hurt. The S&P 500 is headed for the worst week since October 2008. Meanwhile, the United States economy grew at an annual rate of 2.1% in the final quarter of last year, the Commerce Department said Thursday.
In obituaries, John Francis Cobb, Anne Rooney, Christine McCurvey McGinnis, Marjorie Eleanor Anderson Harrington. John Francis Cobb. John Francis Cobb, 73, of Clear Lake, died Thursday, February 27, 2020, at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice in Mason City. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 6, at Clear Lake United Methodist Church, 508 2nd Avenue North, with Pastor Davis Peterson officiating. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 5th at Ward Van Syke Colonial Chapel in Clear Lake. John was born January 5, 1947, the son of Daryl Bill and Loreen Cobb in Eldora, Iowa. A graduate of Eldora High School, class of 1965, he attended Ellsworth Community College and Marshalltown Community College before earning a bachelor's degree from Mankato State College in social work and a background in corrections. He began working at One Vision in 1974, retiring as a team administrator after 34 years in 2008. He was past president of the Clear Lake Chamber of Commerce in 2004 and volunteered frequently throughout the community, especially at the Surf Ballroom. Sobriety was an important part of John's life, as he would have been sober for 42 years on March 1st. He enjoyed bowling, golfing, football, and coaching softball in Clear Lake from 1980 to 1988 for the Milepost Alexander and Breezy sports teams. Most of all, his pride and joy was his daughter and his rock, Kim. He also loved spending time with his grandchildren, who were his world. He is preceded in death by his parents.
Anne Rooney. Anne Rooney, 93, died Wednesday, February 26, 2020, at the Rockville Community Care Center. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, February 29, 2020, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, 305 Elm Street, East Rockville, with the Reverend John Gosman as celebrant. Burial will follow at St. Patrick's Cathedral Catholic Cemetery, Doherty. Visitation will be held Saturday morning at Sacred Heart Parish Center from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m., where the rosary will be read and recited at 11 o'clock. The daughter of James and Agnes Kelly Rooney, Marcella Ann, was born on the family farm outside of Doherty, Iowa, on July 28, 1926. She attended St. Patrick Catholic High School in Doherty, graduated in 1943. She moved to Rockville, with her parents in 1953, and cared for them as well. Her single life involved foremost around her Catholic faith, her many friends, and her family. She was godmother to nieces and nephews, Patty, Jane, Mike, and Joel. Even though her eyesight failed her and she never drove a car, she stayed active as ever. She enjoyed playing cards and crocheting, especially prayer shawls for the sick of the Sacred Heart and potholders for everyone. She also loved cheering on her beloved Minnesota Twins, cooking and baking, especially Scotcheroos and orange drop cookies. She was always busy. If there was anything going on at Sacred Heart, she was there. She appreciated her friends, who always took her along for shopping outings. Trips to Mason City always ended up at a stop at Wendy's for a chocolate frosty for the drive home. Over the years, she was a housekeeper for many priests at the rectory. She cleaned the bank and other businesses with her dear friend Dolores Francis. She also babysat for years and spoke often of her love for Jody Aaron's Sunken and Siddle Kids. Anne is survived by her brother, John Maxine Ronery Algona, 27 nieces and nephews, and so many great and great-great nieces and nephews that were lost count, we've lost count, as well as many friends. The family wishes to thank the staff at Rockville Community Care Center for almost 4 years of devoted and loving care, and to the Mercy One North Iowa Hospice for the comfort care she received. Hogan Bremer Memorial of Colonial Chapel will be in charge.
Christine McKeever McGinnis. Christine McKeever McGinnis, 71 of Lake Mills and formerly of Dow's, passed away Wednesday, February 26, 2020, at her home in Lake Mills. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, March 2nd at Ewing Funeral Home, Central Avenue East in Clarion. Burial will take place at Mount Home Cemetery in Dow's. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Sunday, March 1st at Ewing Funeral Home and will continue 1 hour prior to services at the funeral home on Monday.
Marjorie Eleanor Anderson Harrigan. Marjorie Harrington, 92, of Sheldon, formerly of Kanawha and Belmont, passed away Wednesday, February 26th at Cobble Creek Assisted Living in Sheldon, Iowa. Funeral service for Marjorie Harrington will be held on Friday, February 28, 2020, at 1:30 p.m. at the Ewing Funeral Home, 118 East 2nd Street in Kanawha, with Pastor Godfrey White officiating. Burial will be at the home's Lutheran Cemetery. Visitation will begin at 1 p.m. prior to the funeral services at the funeral home on Friday.
Officials say Iowa is ready for possible coronavirus outbreak. Although it's not possible at this time, the state hygienic lab soon should have the capacity to test patients for the novel coronavirus that is spreading rapidly across the world, Iowa's top public health officials said this week. The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is providing testing kits for COVID-19 to state public health laboratories, including the state of Iowa's Coralville-based lab, state epidemiologist and medical director of the Iowa Department of Public Health, Caitlin Petty, told state senators during a Human Resources Committee meeting Wednesday at the state capitol. Testing for the respiratory virus currently can be done only at CDC facilities. Petty said there were errors noted in the first testing kit sent to the state public health labs and that the CDC was in the process of reissuing those kits. She estimated Iowa should receive those kits in the next 2 weeks. While the risk for an outbreak in Iowa still is low at this time, Padotti said the state public health department is prepared to take on any new cases of the respiratory virus that was first identified in December. Anytime we have the emergence of a new virus that's able to infect people, this is a serious public health concern, she said. But I want to emphasize that this is precisely the kind of concern that the state workers with federal and local partners to prepare for.
Co-creator of popular soap opera dies at 91 in Los Angeles. Lee Philip Bell, who co-created The Young and the Restless and The Bold and the Beautiful and hosted her own daytime talk show in Chicago for 33 years, has died. She was 91. Bell died Tuesday of natural causes at her home in Los Angeles, according to Eva Basler, a spokesman for the family and their company, Bell Philip Television Productions. Our mother was a loving and supportive wife, mother, and grandmother, her family said in a statement. Gracious and kind, she enriched the lives of all who knew her. We will miss her tremendously. Bell and her husband, William J. Bell, co-created two of the daytime television's most successful and enduring dramas. Y&R has been on the air since 1973, while The Bold and the Beautiful will mark its 33rd anniversary in March. Born in Chicago on June 9, 1928, Bell began her career as a broadcast journalist at her hometown, where she hosted and produced her daytime talk show from 1953 to 1986 on WBBM-TV, the local CBS affiliate. She explored timely social issues and concerns while also interviewing presidents Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan, Judy Garland, Cliff Eastwood, Oprah Winfrey, Lucille Ball, and the Beatles, and the Rolling Stones. She won 16 regional Emmy Awards for her show. Bell won a Daytime Emmy Award for her outstanding drama series of Y&R in 1973. She received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Daytime Emmys in 2007. Her husband died in 2005. She is survived by her sons, William and Bradley, and a daughter, Laura Lee Bell Martin, who appears on Y&R. William Bell is president and CEO of the family's production company. Bradley is executive producer and head writer for The Bold and the Beautiful. Her daughter-in-law, Colleen Bell, served as United States Ambassador to Hungary during President Barack Obama's administration and is executive director of the California Film Commission. Another daughter-in-law, Irina Bell, is a former head writer on Y&R. Her other survivors are her son-in-law, Scott Martin, and 8 grandchildren.
Iowa court cases go unresolved far longer than national standards. It may sound cliche to say justice delayed is justice denied, but State Court Administrator Todd Nucino believes justice delayed is frustrating and costly to Iowans. Nucino told lawmakers Wednesday it's somewhat concerning that nearly 21% of domestic relation cases in the state are still pending over a year. The national standard for such domestic cases, marriage dissolution, custody, and paternity, is that no more than 2% of them should be older than a year. It's also quite concerning that 15% of complex civil cases are pending after 2 years, and 30% of regular civil cases are pending after a year. The national standards for those categories are not more than 2% and 10% over the same time periods, respectively. Some delays, he noted, are due to litigants, not the judicial system. In his annual report on the Iowa Judicial Branch and budget request, Nucio sought 4 more district associate judges each year for 5 years, as well as an increase in other courthouse personnel to reduce the time cases remain in the system. The cost of adding 4 judges and other court staff would come to about $2.27 million next fiscal year. We want to be in a position to offer everybody the ability to get timely justice, he said. Is 1 day delay acceptable? Is a year delay acceptable?
And under the sports today, Nyack, a community college wrestling mecca. Trojans ready 9 wrestlers for national championships. For a small community college in rural North Iowa, Nyack has started to create a reputation as a sports hub. With nationally renowned baseball program, 2 ranked baseball teams, and a wrestling squad that was ranked number 1 in the country for much of the season, the Trojans have been thriving. The wrestling team recently qualified 9 athletics for the national championship meet, which will take place on March 6th and 7th in Council Bluffs, Iowa. To head coach Steve Kelly, the key to the program's success lies in the veterans wrestlers. They're not your typical community college kids, Kelly said. A lot of them easily could go on to 4-year schools right out of high school, but they wanted to come here. They liked when they came on the visit, and they liked what we're all about. 2 Nyack wrestlers, 149-pound sophomore Tony Medandis and 165-pound freshman Christian Minto, won district championships on February 16th. Both come from a highly regarded high school wrestling programs in California and Florida, respectively. Mendoza attended Selma High School, just south of Fresno and Mentota is from Mariner High School in Florida. To both coming from those warm locals to the harsh winter climate in Iowa has been an adjustment. It's honestly a lot like my hometown, Mendoza said of Mason City. There isn't a lot to do here, and the weather is always really cold. Back home, my favorite restaurant is to eat is In and Out, and we don't have that out here. It's one of the main reasons, main things I miss. While he misses the California sunshine and tasty local burger chains, Mendoza enjoys the family atmosphere at Nyack. You have assistant coach Don Berry, who is a grandpa of the group, Mendoza said. You have Steve Kelly, who is basically the dad, and then we have Basil Minto, who is kind of a big brother. That's basically how I see it. You have new people every year, which takes getting used to. It's my second year of college, so I'm still getting used to it. Christian Minto doesn't have to look far to find family. Christian is the youngest brother of Nyack associate Basil Minto, who wrestled at Nyack and the University of Northern Iowa. Basil is 7 years older than Kristen and admits that there is a balancing act that comes with coaching your younger brother. Sometimes I say something and I might go in one ear and out the other, Basil says with a laugh, but if he hears it from somebody else, it might work. It's a fine line of give and take, having a brother on the same wrestling team that you are coaching. Basil was a two-time All-American at Nyack before he transferred to UNI. As Christian neared graduation, his older brother gave him the pitch to come to Mason City. Christian was highly ranked coming out of high school, but didn't quite have the grades for a Division I school. Furthermore, Basil wanted a chance to watch Christian wrestle. Steve Kelly treated me good, and I knew he would treat Christian good, Basil said. That was my whole take on it. I missed out on some of the high school wrestling, so I figured if I can get a couple years of coaching him in college, that I hopefully make up for the time of missing some of that time. For Kelly, it takes a lot of work to convince high school kids to take advantage on a small school in North Iowa. There are plenty of recruiting trips and phone calls with recruits and their coaches to sell them on the school. And while the program wins and loses are important, it's just vital to Kelly to help the wrestlers succeed off the mat. You establish the relationship with the high school coaches and with the club coaches, Kelly said. They want their kid to go somewhere where they are going to get taken care of. I think we do a good job, and that's it. It's not about the wins and losses. It's about getting them through school and giving them some credentials so they can have a better life. Kelly has been the head coach of the program since 2010 season and has led the team through plenty of success. This year's 9 Trojan qualifiers are the most for the team since 2016. This probably is the most complete team, Kelly said. Our old teams are at the top end. We're a little bit light. It's one that could be one of the best ones. The nation tournament is going to determine that. According to Basil, the Trojans have a shot to have quite a bit of success on the big meet. We're bringing 9 guys, and I think we can have 9 All-Americans and a couple of national champions in here. He said, we can store a lot of points at nationals.
Osage girls cinch spot at state. In recent seasons, the regional final round has represented the ceiling on the Osage girls basketball team's season. Entering play on Wednesday, the Green Devils had dropped out of the tournament 1 game short of the last 3 seasons. This time, 5th-ranked 2A Osage broke through that ceiling and advanced to the Class 2A state field with a 67-60 win over the 14th-ranked Emmitsburg in a Class 2A regional final at Garter Hayfield Ventura. The girls are not excited about getting there. The girls are not just excited about getting there, Green Devils coach Chad Erickson said. We need to figure out who we play and watch some of the films on them. Osage led through against the E-Hawks and seemed at times to be on the verge of running away with the game. The Green Devils, on the strength of some outstanding shooting in the first quarter, broke out 20-7. Osage was 8 for 10 from the floor over the opening 8 minutes. Emmitsburg, though, pulled within 6 with one quarter to play, but the Osage defense was efficient down the stretch as the E-Hawks never pulled through. That brings us to the end of the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Friday, February 28th, 2020. Your readers have been Anna Marie Wilson and Diana Black. This broadcast has come to you through a partnership between the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of IRIS or KCMR. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for today's reading of the Des Moines Register. You are listening to IRIS, your 24-hour radio reading service. Have a great day.